Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 2. The St. Fursey Police Department station had once been the Senior Citizen Center. It inherited the senior's flat, latex pink walls and white woodwork and some womanly kitchen curtains. They hung in finger pleats all across the high windows, a cotton yellow with a pattern of ivy and baskets full of fruit of some kind that is always out of season in northern Minnesota. Bernice Dukowski disdained the look of the place, even after everything his wife had tried to do to make it nice for him. Gladys and he had shoved all the requisite locked file cases down to the far end of the room. A cross-stitched table prayer hung on one wall. Most police stations had patriotic messages and a picture of the President of the United States. The senior citizens have left up a picture of President Clinton. There were a lot of Democrats in St. Fursey, so no one so far objected. No one was crazy about Clinton after the sex stuff, but then they hadn't liked anyone since either. Bernie's deputy, the darkest bulb on any Christmas tree, envied the deputy at Culla because of their office. The Culla cops had 2 36-inch wide commercial photos of patrol cars leaning forward, the front wheels nearly off the ground, with the manufacturer's names on them. Nice slogans. A car you can count on for the heroes we count on. A cityscape of New York showing the World Trade Center towers with the legend in old English semi-bold. We will never forget. St. Fursey Station showed only blurry digitals of Gladys and Bernie himself and the children in metal certificate frames from the Ben Franklin store before it closed its door. This Friday forenoon, the sun shined through the orange and yellow fruit and green leaves in the curtains. The deputy kept pacing round, clearly working up to beg for something. Daryl had been in training with Bernie for 2 months, so Bernie knew all his moves. He would start with some neutral remark, then his own voice would give him courage. He would move into outright begging. This time, since it was a Friday, he probably wanted the rest of the day off. That wasn't going to happen. Bernie did not mind Daryl's whining and begging because he, himself, had been a bum policeman in his 20s. He had been a bum cop in a different way, but still not much good. He had not tried out and flunked the state trooper's test the way Daryl had, but he had swaggered around the same way, longing very secretly for a chance to draw his revolver on someone while all the time maintaining, for the old ladies and anyone else who asked, how much policemen really hated violence and all the time wished they didn't have to use force. In St. Fursey, there was always some chance to sound off to old ladies. They called when they heard something scary in the Denham apartment building, so you ran flashlights around and then stayed long enough to talk to them a little. It pained Bernie to hear old Mrs. Garris saying what a nice young officer Daryl was. It pained him all the more because it reminded him of how he had postured around in front of old ladies, too. But he didn't ever recall having given his chief the particular worries that this Daryl now gave him. Daryl lied in a natural flow. The man's brain-dead waste ran out of his mouth like bad water from a culvert. It was the naturalness of Daryl's lying that irritated Bernie. It was no good speaking to him about it because Daryl would only be confused. To Daryl, words were something you used to relieve yourself of the moment's tension. Words do not symbolize a past action. Words do not constitute a promissory note for any future action. Daryl made promises because he knew he would feel better after he had spoken. It just barely mattered which words he chose to speak. Worse, he was a mama's boy. Bernie wasn't going to make a fight out of Daryl's lying, or out of his being so scared of facing old tough guys like Walt Steinsider, who needed to obey the law the way everyone else was supposed to. He meant to bawl Daryl out for begging for hours off, and in the next breath, inquiring about promotion. But Bernie wouldn't bawl him out for being a coward, because that was what he was going to fire him for. He would simply wait, keep track with each day of the man's ducking his duties. Bernie didn't see how he could teach Daryl to have a conscience. His experience was that either you couldn't teach heartless people to feel remorse, or otherwise that he himself just wasn't a good teacher. Now he said, "Daryl, why don't you go get fresh Danish and some bagels from Denham's, and don't stop in there to talk to anyone?" "I was going to ask you, though, Bernie. I mean, ask me what? I mean, how come it's us hanging around the station, and it's them guys from Homicide, whoever they are, who answered your call and are out there investigating that poor kid's murder? How come it isn't us investigating?" Daryl had got on his service jacket, but now sat down. Bernie found it painful to see the vivid St. Fursey police patch on Daryl's shoulder. It showed a brilliant rose sunset over a northern Minnesota forest. It reminded Bernie of a conversation he had had when he was a young policeman. He and his chief had been walking away from the yellow ribbon of a crime site between Cullah and St. Fursey. Along the highway shoulder lay the picked-over corpse of a rabbit. It had been yanked apart and bitten into several pieces so that its parts now lay lightly as much as 3 or 4 feet apart. The men noticed that some crows stood poised at a thoughtful distance. At that time in his career, Bernie had called corpses stiffs. "Boy, those guys, the crows, have already cleaned off this stiff all right," Bernie had said. Now that he had seen a few hundred more stiffs, he called them corpses, or just bodies. His boss had said, "Those crows, they've hardly had a taste of this fellow yet. They're just waiting for us to quit jawing so they can feed. No, some very big wood folk, more than one, caught this rabbit and began tearing it open. Rich, soft parts first, just about clean. Maybe a pack of something. Those crows are about fourth or fifth in line." That cop had been the only man back then who used words like wood folk. Nowadays, the only person who talked like that was Peter Tenebrae. Well, and some of the summer people who loved nature and said so. Daryl said, "If we ain't investigating all those people in Denham's bakery," Bernie said, "Daryl, how would you know there was a lot of people in Denham's? Shouldn't be that you already stopped by there on your way back from taking Dieter Stoltz home?" "No, heck no. I just looked in is all. Though that great big new window they got, you can see everything. The place was jumping. I didn't go in at all. I was only in there for a moment." "You did go in." "No, heck no. I wasn't in there 2 minutes altogether." Daryl went on. "Here's the thing, Bernie. When I go get the Danish and bagels, they're all going to ask me, 'How's the investigation coming along?' So what am I going to say? I mean, I got to say something." "That's a good question, Daryl, and here's the answer. I think if you stand at the counter and don't go over to any of the tables and order the buns and pay, get out of there, you won't have to answer anything because no one will ask you anything. But say someone does shout at you from one of those tables they got. Say some loudmouth shouts over to you, 'Hi, Daryl, how's it going with investigating that young girl's death?' You can look at them and say, 'We're cooperating with the authorities,' which is all I can tell you at this point. You got that?" Bernie looked at Daryl's face across the table. He thought to himself, "I think I better repeat that. So you tell them, 'See, we're cooperating with the authorities,' which is all I can tell you at this point."
"Are you saying we ain't going to investigate this crime at all?" Darrell said. Bernie said, "That's right. We ain't going to investigate this crime. We're going to cooperate. So if someone asks you, you say, 'I can't tell you much at the moment, but we are cooperating with the homicide people.' You can say, 'From Duluth.' You know, homicide specialists can be from just about anywhere, but since the road here comes up from Duluth, you can say, 'From Duluth,' okay? Then if they say, 'Yeah, but Darrell, how about that autopsy that Doc Anderson has on for tomorrow afternoon over at the Cullough Hospital? That's for this dead girl, isn't it?' You can say, 'I can't tell you anything more.' Darrell, you make sure you're on your feet. If you stay standing up, they will respect you for refusing to be unprofessional. But if you once sit down with them and then refuse to answer questions, you will just sound snotty. When you went in there already this morning, by the way, did you go over to any of the tables?"
"No, I was only in there a second. I went over to say hello to Vera, you know, from the school where they were sitting. I didn't sit down with them. I bet I sat there all of 30 seconds, tops."
Bernie sighed. "You'd probably better go now so you're back and we can give those Duluth M.E.s and homicide people a snack if they chose to stick their heads in here." When the door closed, its ruffled curtain puffed out a second and fell straight again. Bernie let himself slope lower into place. He sat as deeply as he could in a chair like that old Meals on Wheels staff chair and thumped the table with the huge heels of his hands. He was not interested in the roadside murder, and never would be, because he knew in his heart of hearts that it was unsolvable. He had to keep that insight to himself. Even if Darrell had been any kind of a promising cop, Bernie would not have shared his speculations with him. When a large organization, whoever they are, commits a crime for some reason of his own, Bernie's experience was, no one will solve it. To someone like those large organization leaders, everywhere outside their own offices in their own suburbs is just somewhere to dump a body, wherever you happen to have a body that needs dumping. St. Fursey, Minnesota, Paris, France, or Tokyo, Japan. Bagram, Afghanistan, all the same. This big, purposeful organization is going to have money and attorneys enough to head off any inquiry that any small-town cop, Minnesota, might devise. Bernie thought, if he was them, he would even have people dressed up as cops. These people would very slowly and respectfully show you their ID so you could actually see the picture, read three or four lines of text. They would talk the talk just as convincingly as the two friendly, cordial guys this morning had. Once Darrell had driven off, nice guys with their pale raincoats open and white shirts and tweed jackets, ties, also that very courteous man, woman, marks, and photo crew. Bernie did not think this murder was by a serial killer or rapist because the body was dumped off with no attempt to delay discovery. A rural setting serial killer typically wanted at least a 24-hour cooling off of the trail before he found the body. He would bury it somewhere, or at least drag it all the way into some woods or an unused meadow. Not these folks. It is true the body had not been spotted for several days, but it could have been. The murderer didn't care. Bernie noticed he had begun to think of the young girl's killers as these folks. It made him feel less scared and more indifferent. Okay, these folks didn't trouble to hide the body. That suggested they got someone else, not themselves, to do the actual dumping. And this someone else had to do it once asked. That suggested someone they had something on, but whom they would keep so completely in the dark that even if the dumper started to talk, he had no one very clear to point to. And as for the young woman, her death was probably a convenience death. She died because the organization needed to punish someone, or they needed to frighten someone. It was this last likelihood that made Bernie uneasy. They might actually be trying to frighten someone. If they wanted a dead body found right here, south of St. Fursey, they may have planned for it for evidence designed to show up later, not now. Someone might be a local. So Bernie drummed his hand lightly. If these people were setting up a potential frame-up for a local, that local had either a past that no local authorities, meaning Bernie, would know about, or a present that no local authorities knew about. The beautiful woods were full of knotholes. In the knotholes lived dozens and dozens of two-legged varmints and heroes and everything in between, 11 times as many in the summers as in the winters, but these days a few hundred stayed year-around. The retired or pre-retired didn't make their living locally. In the last 30 years, even much younger people had built nice places back in the woods. They were dentists and doctors and investors, people who made their living somewhere else. These people could have all sorts of enemies that Bernie would never know anything about. Besides, except for the meth farmers and other trash, their faces didn't show up in his line of work. The more educated couples showed up at community events. If they were poor but not engaged in crime, they came to the annual ecumenical chorus rehearsals for the snacks that would be served during the breaks. When there was a Veterans Evening lecture, like the one coming up soon, people appeared, whom you never saw anywhere else, along with the regular crowd of the old and the poor. A lot of these people didn't do their regular shopping at Marty's Super Value. Gladys had told Bernie that high-end people drove to Duluth for less sugar-based deli, more ethnic food supplies. Neighbors no longer necessarily knew one another. That was not counting the meth tweakers or the think tank people at a swish retreat camp between St. Fursey and Culla. Bernie saw those people because he occasionally dropped in to tell them to watch themselves. He would warn them that a bad type was out loose around and he would keep in touch. It was just a courtesy. That think tank, disguised as a duck hunting camp, had its own security, as thick and implacable as the stars in the sky. Bernie's guess was that their weaponry was so electronic and modern he wouldn't recognize a lot of it. Bernie wasn't surprised to hear there was a crowd at Denham's Bakery Cafe. There was probably a crowd at the other two cafes, too. There would be a crowd at the churches on Sunday. A roadside murder was like 9/11, a treat for ordinary people. This particular roadside murder had its tiny blessings. The victim was not local, so no one had to feel guilty about not mourning. You could just enjoy it. The crime was violent enough to be interesting. Murder and very probably rape. So although St. Fursey people might intuitively decide that the perpetrator wasn't a local, they would speculate aloud to one another anyhow. The usual local suspects, who this November were St. Fursey's six-year-round trash types, one bad summer people kid, one old naturalized foreigner, would be raked out again. The old foreigner was the least intriguing since his only crime was to have been an infantryman on the wrong side during World War II. Still, the wits were sipping coffee at Denham's, usually shared a three-part philosophy. You never really knew, did you? And you can't tell. Not for sure you can't. And frankly, they'd always been afraid something like this would happen. Their loose-limbed ideas left the field open for anybody. Bernie would do the usual. Let himself be seen driving here and there to interview those of the six-year-round trash he could find. The bad summer people kid from the last crime had grown up and gone away. The one foreigner, Dieter Stoltz, was no longer a new kid on the block. Dieter had it in common with the Salem witches that he did hands-on nurture of fruit trees better than most farmers, and his midways and sparkles were 10 times sweeter than the other farmers' strawberries. Often as not, the witches had nothing more against them than excellence at propagating plants and making wild berry jelly. A curious point about an external murder. It drew the town together. A little. People would say, my treat, and buy coffee for other people they seldom nodded to. With their heads thrown back like statues of lions or army officers of long ago, St. Fursey people would trade notes on who might have done it. Bernie knew all the conversations without hearing them. For example, old Dieter Stoltz was 78 and sure seemed to be more giving to saving people out of illegal beaver traps than killing children. But you never knew. So what he spoke English so perfectly? He was a foreigner, and everyone knew it. And in everyone's favorite war, he had served on the wrong side. That's got to stand for something, doesn't it? A lot of years of running a first-rate specialty strawberry operation, a lot of years of being a nice person, not to mention being a tenor who could actually read music in the Episcopal Church, plus being fairly recently widowed, all that might get him some natural sympathy. But suspicion would flare up anyway. Darrell reached the bakery on foot because Bernie had told him not to park the squad car anywhere near the place. Darrell got chilled walking. He hated getting a chill. He was almost hung over, and now he was going to get a chill. He and Bertie had already got cold out along Little Bass Lake, and the warm smell of the bakery was just killing him. Bernie had guessed right. Darrell no sooner got in there, in his uniform jacket, with the fur edging, than everyone paused in their talk. People simply looked hungrily at Darrell. When Darrell made it clear he would put in an order standing up at the counter, nobody dared ask him questions. But he could feel it. People were a little bored all the time. Most people didn't like their jobs much. They didn't mind them and usually were glad to have them, but the fact was their work bored them. They were probably bored a third of the time at home, too. They weren't ever going to be a policeman like himself. He felt sorry for them as he pulled his wallet out from his sheepskin. When he got back with the paper bag, he told Bernie his idea even before he got his jacket hung up. Darrell was pleased to have got it right for once about how people were bored. His boss liked deep thinking and sometimes seemed to be implying that Darrell didn't think deeply enough. Well, now he'd know. He could see Bernie was really listening. If he could get Bernie talking deep stuff, the man would be pleased and might give Darrell the afternoon off, even. Bernie was doing his own worrying as he helped Darrell lay out the bakery stuff. The chief knew that people would start by pointing at Brad Stropp or Dieter Stoltz, since they had been near where the body was found. By tomorrow or the next day, they would give up on those two suspects for lack of evidence. But not yet this morning. Most St. Fursey people tended not to steal. They tended not to kill. Well and good. Except that every year, Bernie, the other town's chief, the county sheriff, and the state troopers plying that area came in contact with 16,000 cases of mental illness causing bad behavior. When Bernie had been an aspiring young cop, all but two or three of the bad things that happened around St. Fursey happened because someone in a 50-mile range did some logically motivated bad thing. Someone stole a good hunting dog because they wanted that particular dog or one like it. Bernie and the other city cops and the county sheriff would hook up and compare notes on the telephone. They decide who might have stolen the dog, and they'd drive out to amble around that person's place, one or two of them holding leashes. Usually, the dog was there, so they would take it back. Nowadays, a dog got stolen. Bernie figured it might not have anything to do with the dog or its owner. Dog theft, like murder, could be just a red herring or something else. That social worker at the school, Emma Jean Tenebrae, told him that sometimes people stole things while scarcely noticing what it was they'd lifted. So what did they want? He had asked. She said that they typically wanted the feeling of getting hold of something they hadn't ever had hold of before. Well, there wasn't anything much in police school that taught Bernie how to investigate that kind of crime. Bernie told Daryl to look up the registration on Brad Strop's rifle. That girl wasn't killed with a rifle, though, Daryl said.
That's right, Bernie said, but look it up. Look up all Strop's stuff. I think he has a varmint rifle of some kind, maybe a .22, but the one I think we're going to find will be a .30-30 Winchester. We'll go looking for it around down at the lake end of that path.
Hey, I bet those homicide people will show up soon, Daryl said.
They might, Bernie said. They might show up to eat Danish and drink the coffee and share some conversation and philosophy and talk of clues left or not left. They wouldn't want Bernie to feel left out. The biggest possibility, however, was that they would just go back to Duluth and call out of ordinary courtesy from there. Or they would wait until they had that autopsy report from Doc Anderson and then tell Bernie to just go ahead with the usual stuff.
Come on, Daryl, let's us eat this stuff, Bernie said. The plate of buns had been smelling wonderful. Both men set to.
They waited another 10 minutes. Bernie stood up.
Okay, let's go out along that lake path and see what we can see. Don't forget your cap.
I guess those guys aren't coming then, Daryl said.
Bernie checked the car trunk to make sure they had the saw. Then they drove south out of town. They left the police car north of the old dump site. The yellow police ribbon was gone. You could see that people had trampled the goldenrod and burning weed, but that was all. A few late leaves cruised down. The forest was silent, but for their feet on leaves already dried. They went past the bony aspen and birch, following a line parallel to the north of the path that Dieter had brought out Brad Strop on. Bernie wanted to leave Dieter's route untouched until he could study it without the presence of his deputy. He meant to send Daryl out on an errand this afternoon, and then he would return alone. About 100 yards from the highway, he made a right turn to cut over to Dieter's path. They came upon the conibear trap and the smashed undergrowth and disturbed leaves where Dieter had freed Strop. Bernie tied a length of pink tree tape 7 feet up around a nearby trunk.
Okay, he said, let's walk around this going outward. Do one circle at about 4 feet, another at 8, another at 12. I don't think he will have thrown that rifle very far because the odds would be it hit a tree before 10 or 18 yards at the most. Besides, he was caught in a trap, and he was in some pain.
Here you be, Bernie, Daryl said in a casual tone, as if he were a man of such huge competence that of course he had spotted the flung weapon first. He shouldered his way back through some poplar saplings, holding up a rifle.
Let's see what we got, Bernie said. Fired within a few hours.
Okay, hang onto it, would you, and I'll take the trap.
He got down on his knees, held the chain taut, and sawzalled through at the bolt. When he stood up, he paused and stalled a moment, looking around.
Ain't that about it? Daryl said. He rubbed his hands.
Bernie looked at him ironically. You in a hurry to get somewhere, Daryl?
Heck no, but I mean,
man fired 2 shots. I thought we might see what he was firing at if we nosed around a little.
All we got is that old strawberry farm guy's word for it, about the 2 shots, Daryl said.
Yeah, I trust that guy more than I trust the 10 o'clock news, Bernie said.
You've been listening to episode 2 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.